He's a real nowhere man, sitting in his nowhere land, making all his nowhere plans for nobody. Doesn't have a point of view, knows not where he's going to. Isn't he a bit like you and me? Nowhere man, please listen. You don't know what you're missing. Nowhere man, the world is at your command.
Do anything.
Yeah.
Yeah? Is that better?
Yeah, way better.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hold on 1 second. Testing, testing. Okay, that's working on my recorder. Perfect. Okay, so.
Thank you. Jesus Christ.
Here we go. Did you hear
that? Thank you. Was that thank you, comma, Jesus Christ, or thank you, Jesus Christ, period?
Oh, did I say Jesus Christ?
You said thank you, Jesus Christ.
Oh, it could be both. You can, however you slice the pizza, still pizza. It's okay.
However you slice your savior, it's still good.
Okay, right. Speaking of which,
I sliced mine into 14 pieces.
Yeah, that's the thing with the three Vavs. And like this came up yesterday around 666. I'm kind of just here. I'm inevitably repeating some of the things that I've said many times, but they're really interesting points. So like 666 is literally three Vavs. Like you'll see it on the monster can, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those are the nails. Vav literally is nail. So three sixes is literally the three nails that hold open the cube of space as the cross, which you could relate to the what we were just going around good, because literally it's two hands that are open, right? So you have 14 times 3 becomes 42, and 42 is what's held within the tefillin cube as the 42 letter name. And so yeah, anyways, it's just interesting that those all connect together. That's the meaning of 666 being the Babylonian sun square, the sun, and then you have the sun within the cube of space, holding open the cube of space as the Rosicrucian cross. So, yeah.
So, here's something. What I was trying to ask about was, did you hear synchronized episode 3, where Zenor did a reading of about funeral parade of roses.
I did not.
Oh, you should hear that. That's fucking awesome.
Wanted to. I didn't get around to it. Yeah.
Have you guys watched Funeral Parade of Roses?
Times.
Andras, have you seen it yet?
I'm sorry to say I have not seen it yet.
Oh, loser. it's so good. Well,
so between the three of us, though, two of us have heard Zenor's thing, and two of us have seen Funeral Parade of Roses. We should be able to hold it down.
All right. It's just a sort of point I want to make is that you have in Funeral Parade of Roses, it's this Oedipus story, and the character stabs out his eyes. So it's a sort of homosexual take on the Oedipus story. And if you listen to Zenor's thing, which is really good, you'll kind of go deeper into that. That it's not exactly a reversal of the Oedipus story, but regardless. What I find so interesting is, a spoiler here, at the end of Funeral Parade of Roses, the father, once they realize that the son has been sleeping with the father, the son stabs out his eyes, a la Oedipus, but the father also commits suicide, and he does this with a ceremonial sword. And this is interesting because the other thing that I noticed is that the word Oz is made up of and I'm sorry if I mispronounce this, Ayan and Zayn?
Ayan and Zion.
Ayan and Zion. So those two letters would be sword and eye.
Yes.
So here, one of the things we talked about in the episode, so Zenor does this thing about Funeral Parade of Roses, and I do a thing talking about different eye symbolism and so on. But I think it's so fascinating that then the...
Ooh, that's good. I never noticed that. I'm sorry to interrupt, but that's the lovers and the devil. And if you look at, especially like in the rider deck, you got the lovers are chained to the devil.
Yeah.
Wow. I never even stopped to contemplate that. Holy fuck. And then it's the lovers in the fucking thing of the Oedipal story. Wow. Jesus Christ. Okay, sorry.
And you have the idea that a common idea of the Devil Tarot card would be a need to overcome lust. But of course, then we have the lust card. I'm just going to play with, just throw you some quick notes I have here. So Oz being eye and sword. So you have what Zenor talks about is Funeral Parade and Eyes Wide Shut, or Oz Wide Shut. Mm-hmm. And then this idea of both, even in Eyes Wide Shut, you have, do you want to go where the rainbow ends? And then he goes to the clothing store, which is under the rainbow, et cetera, et cetera. This idea of the Oz and I connection seems... a really interesting angle that I hadn't really considered before. But where you're going with this, where you're talking about the devil card, is another area I wanted to hit on. I'd have to kind of explain how I got there, but I've been thinking about the lust card of the tarot as corresponding to Ergo. This sort of, and then we could take this in the direction of Catcher in the Rye or things like that. So basically, I've been watching this really, really good cartoon. It's called Cardcaptor Sakura. And I know they made an English version, where they overdubbed the voices, but and as bad as English dubs usually are, this one is apparently even worse because they cut out like 70% of the footage. So they would combine like a few scenes from episode 27 and a few scenes from episode 49 and a few scenes from episode 50 to make an episode for English audiences. It's like pretty ridiculous. So if anyone's interested, please watch the Japanese version with English subtitles, as you should with any Japanese animation or any foreign movie out there. Let's put it there. But So this thing is basically, it's this little girl. It's like somewhat of a kid's show, but it's definitely not childish. And the idea is this little girl, it starts off, she finds this book and she opens it and it's full of tarot cards and they all spill out and they like scatter over the city where she lives. And basically she has to go and collect them. And like this beast of the seal comes out of the book and says to her, if you don't collect all the tarot cards again, some great catastrophe is going to befall the world. So it's basically his way of getting her to do it. And it's kind of like, so it's ridiculously intentional symbolism on a lot of levels. What happens is when she first opens the book and they all spill out, she picks up one card and it's the wind card. And she picks it up and she just reads it and she goes, wind? And by saying it out loud, she sort of activates it. And this huge gust of wind comes in and scatters the cards everywhere. But of course you have the divine wind, which this is the card throughout the series, even when she has multiple cards, that's the card she uses the most. And we could take this as being the Shekinah or the divine wind. So it's very obvious that she's really keeps using this wind card. But what's just fascinating to me is the concept of it, that even though it's intentional symbolism, it's really well done. And it's basically that she has to kind of confront what's happening is the cards are kind of manifesting and the archetypes are manifesting and start to tear shit up. And then she has to kind of learn how to tame or master each archetype. So she's kind of going through the tarot deck, confronting these archetypes, and then has to confront them and overcome them and figure out how do I kind of contain this energy. Granted, they're not using explicit tarot cards. They make up like a bunch of other ones. But nonetheless, there's a ton of real tarot symbolism. And one of the things as I'm first watching this thing is the book that she picks up is called The Clow, C-L-O-W. And that's the name of these cards, and they're Clow cards. And I'm like, well, why Clow? Why Clow? What the fuck is Clow? And I was like, well, at first I'm thinking could be a silly thing. It's like, well, is this like a play on Crowley? And I'm like, well, that might be a stretch. I'm like, so whatever. But I keep thinking about it, and then it occurs to me that in Asiatic languages, there is no distinction between an L and an R. This is why, like, the stereotypes of, like, fried lice or, you know, like really horrible things that you would see in, like, 80s movies where they're making fun of Asian people and they switch the R's and the L's. It's because there is no difference. They have a sound that's kind of in between L and R. So it's when we try and Romanize it, it gets switched. So if you've ever met someone with the last name Ree, R-E-E, or if you've ever met someone with the last name Lee, L-E-E, it's the same lineage. It's just some people decide to Romanize it with an R, some with an L. So when I realize that, I'm like, oh, it's Crow. So when they're saying, they're writing as C-L-O-W, and it's written in English, even though it's a Japanese cartoon, they're writing these certain words in English. And she picks up this book and it says C-L-O-W. But I'm like, but that's really C-R-O-W. And they say that this book, at some point, this becomes obvious to me, is they say the book was invented by this great sorcerer, Clow Reed. But again, switching the L's and the R's and realizing that if a Japanese person were to try and pronounce an American word like Reed, they would leave the D off. So you would basically say Clow Reed or Crow Lee. Mm-hmm. And then at some point she meets this other character who's another descendant of this sorcerer. And this guy is a Chinese guy whose last name is Li, L-I. So again, and they're saying this was the sorcerer's mother's name. So he's either
Crowley or Crowley, like mm-hmm. either way. So no matter how you wanted to pronounce that, if it was his mother's name or his father's name, they're saying this is Crowley. This is Crowley's tarot deck, right?
Dig it.
So, and just to say, I don't want to talk about this, like no one else has seen this cartoon. If anyone wants to, it's been so enjoyable watching this series. But they have things like her, the guardian of the seal is this little lion. And he says, he's stuck in this other form and he can't reveal his true form until she finds the sun card. Because that's his, basically his card. So here you have the lion is the sun, and it's like, okay, I get it. But he's literally like a little baby lion until she collects all the cards and he gets all his magic back. He can't become a full-sized lion. So here you have baby lion, or which I've said many times that the Babylon being baby lion. Now, I decided to do a little research into the people who made this series, and there it's these three like middle-aged Japanese women who do these comic books, and a lot of them have been turned into anime and stuff like that. The main writer, which is really interesting to me, the main writer wears an eye patch because she has a damaged right eye, which you might remember that the Funeral Parade of Roses, the short film that he released at the same time with the same some of the same footage, was called For My Damaged Right Eye.
Right, yep.
So this is like, okay, this is, and we start getting to some sinky stuff. But these women, they have these, they did one series which was called Tokyo Babylon. So, okay, here's a direct hit. And they have this other series, and I don't remember exactly what it was called, but as I was reading the Wikipedia page about it, the whole story is that they go to this, you guys familiar with Tokyo Tower? It basically looks kind of like the Eiffel Tower. It's a very big landmark in Tokyo. It looks kind of like the Eiffel Tower. But these characters confront, they go to the Tokyo Tower and they get transported to this other world, and it's the world, I believe the way they spelled it was C-E-P-H-I-R-O. How would you pronounce that? Sephiro? So it's like this whole idea that they have to, and that there's, they go there and there's these three pillars and they have to bring balance to these three pillars in the world of Sephiro. And I'm like, okay. Like, this is like really intentional.
Yeah, it's pretty direct.
But okay, then there's, just give you one last thing. There's even this thing where in one episode, the little lion guardian angel says, he refers to himself as the holy guardian angel, which Crowley fans will appreciate. So there's all this sort of stuff. And as I'm thinking about the distinction between the L and the R being switched, and I'm thinking that this little lion is the lion of the strength or lust card, I realize that you can just as easily change lust to rust.
And rust never sleeps, man.
Rust never sleeps. And Chris Knowles, so as I'm thinking all this, we do the Chris Knowles episode, and Chris Knowles is talking about the old mystery schools and how these in these mysteries they might have been using, now he was making a reference to ergot, but he says something like wheat rust, which of course if you know, this was another name for it. They would see what looked like rust appearing on the wheat crops.
Totally.
And that what looked like rust was actually the ergot, the psychedelic substance. So then you have this idea of lust becoming rust, and if you look at the Thoth deck's lust card, it's really the color of rust. Mm-hmm. Now, granted, it's the hermit card, which is interesting that we kept talking about the hermit, because one of the things, at the same time, Patrick Sivek puts on Facebook the idea that the hermit card in the Thoth deck shows the hermit in a field of wheat, and he was comparing this to the catcher in the rye.
Well, it's all, Which card did you say? The Hermit?
Yeah.
Right, it's also in the Empress in the Rider deck.
Yes. Sorry, I don't mean to disregard that. I'm just saying, like, I'm kind of taking you through my steps of, like, so Patrick puts up the thing about the Hermit card. I'm thinking about the Lust card as indicating rust. And I love that you said rust never sleeps, because that's actually one of my things I've written here. It's like Neil Young, who did the album and concert Rust Never Sleeps, last year he did this tour that both Bill and I happened to see. And you know, he basically took elements from his famous Rust Never Sleeps concert and reused some of it, but changed some of it. And he called the tour Alchemy Never Works. So you have Rust Never Sleeps becomes Alchemy Never Works. And the picture for the Alchemy Never Works tour was like a golden Statue of Liberty.
Ooh, that's good, especially because the Statue of Liberty has the chains at its feet that are broken, which is like,
is that the lovers overcoming their lust?
I was thinking about the chains of the lovers in the Devil card.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Trippy.
So, yeah, these are the things where my head is at. Do you have any, thinking of the Lust card as Urgot correspondence, which it's not explicit, and I'm just kind of playing with it here, but you have the idea that that card indicates an intoxication and all this sort of stuff.
Oh yeah, well that's big time emphasized if you read the chapter in the Book of Thoth on that card.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
It's all about that. And so it's one very important thing about that card, you know, that I talked about is that its pathway on the tree is between Chesed and Gevurah, or mercy and severity, right? Which is, it's the card above Tiferet that is holding the tree itself in place as the split Adam. So like it's holding, it's between the two pillars. And so of course the two pillars are Yachin and Boaz, which are established in Oz, in strength. And so just in case if there was any doubt of what Oz is implying, in the Wizard of Oz and beyond, you can see it's represented, its placement on the tree is very specific. And so it's interesting too, thinking about that you have the lightning flash, which if you go through in the European version of the tree, you get 777 if you add up all the letters. It's interesting then that the pathway that is above Tiferet between the two pillars, Oz has the value of 77 if you look at it as strength. And so that's awesome. I don't know. I've mentioned that before, but it's pretty, I think it's pretty important.
And that's one of the things in Suicide Kings that I'm really focusing on is, and it's funny because this stems out of a conversation I had with Jason where he makes the point in Sync Book Volume 1 that Flight 77 crashing into the Pentagon is a veiled 777 lightning flash. But I was thinking that if 77 is Oz, is strength, is a sort of rising up the tree. So this was a way back. We get into this big conversation. Is there a distinction? Is 77 a rising up the tree, and is 777 a descent down the tree? And then, you know, ultimately coming to the point that it almost doesn't matter in a lot of ways, and in a lot of ways it does. Like you've talked about 2001: A Space Odyssey, where it appears to be showing you an ascent of the tree, but it might actually be flipped. So it's the idea of, are you, like, if you don't know which way you're going, you know, any path will take you there.
Yeah, well, there's this idea that we keep coming across in what we're studying, that I study with my teacher, where he's emphasizing the appearance of elevation when actually it's a further descent. So you can be you can have the sense that you're really, because of the nature of the klipot, because there's four veils to the klipot, because the shells that surround the tree of life. And so, like, the idea of you till the soil in order to get to the tree, and that as we move through one veil of klipot, we think we've transcended, but we're actually just in, it's like a nut. So they look at it like you have a thinner surrounding, like around a walnut, when you actually get it from the tree, not like what you buy in the store, but there's like a thinner veil that you go through, and then you get to the harder part, and then after that there's two more within the nut that you, before you actually get to the meat. And so they have this idea that you feel like you've gone so far when really you may have only have gotten through the thinnest veil, and then even if you get through the thickest veil, there's still two more veils, meaning that there's no ascent until you transcend altogether. And at that point, you know, so it's just because we have this basis of comparison. So we're compared to the ignorance we were in, we think we've really gotten somewhere, but really, you know, are we there yet? So,
well, this is something that I'm the perfect segue into the last sort of thing that I wanted to bring up this week is probably the first conversation I ever had with Michael Schacht. He had asked me if I ever read a book called Flatland, and I had never read it, and for whatever reason I never found myself, like he mentioned it, and it sort of mentioned in passing, and then it sort of stewed in my brain for a minute and then was gone. And then I ended up finding this book, I found a used copy of this book just a few weeks ago, and reading it, what you're saying was exactly, I understand why I didn't read this book until now, because what we've been talking about, the idea of if 2001 A Space Odyssey, if Dave Moman, it appears to be an ascension going beyond the infinite, but he ends up in this cube, and we talked last week about the idea of, does he end up transcending the screen? Does he get trapped in the screen? Does he leave Plato's cave? Is he in a version of Jim Henson's The Cube? Did you watch that, by the way?
No, I had to leave my trip right after
that. That's right.
I just got back.
I was making connections between the 2001 White Room and The Cube from Jim Henson's The Cube. So it was the idea of, like, exactly that. Like, do you think you're transcending when you're actually not? So this story of Flatland is all about a square that lives on a two-dimensional plane. And the first half of the book is him describing his world, that it's just this two-dimensional world, and even though he's a square and there are triangles and circles, since they have no height, when they look at each other, all they see is a straight line. If you looked at a circle in a two-dimensional perspective, you would see a straight line. If you did a triangle, all you could see is a straight line. It goes to all this stuff about, like, how they tell each other apart, what their world is like, and they only have north, south, east, west movement. And then he has this vision where he goes to line land, which is just a two-dimensional world, and it's just a straight line, and all these characters are lines along this straight line. And he tries to explain to them, like, why don't you try and move to your side? And they're like, well, what are you, there's nothing there. There is, like, they just have no context for what it means to move anything other than north or south, because that the whole world they know is this straight line. And all they could see is the person in front of them or behind them is just a point. And just this whole, so they describe that world. And he gets super frustrated that he can't explain to this character in the two-dimensional world what it means. And then he ends up going to the 3D world, what they call Spaceland, and a sphere is trying to explain to him the same thing. And he's saying, you just move up. And he's like, you mean north? And he's like, no, not north, but up into another, there's another direction. And it's, so the whole thing is basically trying to show how frustrating it would be if you were a higher dimensional being, or that we can't really comprehend what is a fourth dimension.
I was just talking about this in the same way to Amy, because we went to the Krishnamurti Foundation in Ojai on our trip. And I don't know how familiar you are with Krishnamurti and his work with David Bohm, but I was explaining, like, essentially what happens with Krishnamurti and the way that he himself, at one point in The Ending of Time, conversation with David Bohm, he has this whole, like, idea that if you go to somebody, the same kind of idea, like higher dimensional thinking, you go to somebody and you're like, you've been going north your entire life. And if you say, you know, well, why don't you try going south? And it's completely, they have no way of relating to that. The same thing that you're talking about. He was saying that in and of itself is something. If they go in a different direction, that's, people don't often even experience that. But then once you're like, get to the point where you've gone north, you've gone south, you've gone east, you've gone west, and you start to realize that as far as you go in any of these directions, that they're ultimately, you're still within the same parameters.
Mm-hmm.
He was like, how do you explain a completely different movement that's not a movement in any of the directions that have ever been known? Because he's saying this about thought, that thought will go here, thought will go there, and thought will think that it's doing something when actually it's not doing anything. And how do you bring in another thing? So that's an essence of inertia, right? It's something that's moving in a straight line that won't deviate its course unless if it's acted upon by some other directional force that's outside of itself. And so how do you bring that about? And that's Krishnamurti's whole deal, because he's like, all systems, because they're based within this framework, are ultimately going to build disorder, because any order that's achieved is like, is going to inevitably, eventually, in the long run, fall apart by its very nature, because it's under this, you know, birth, growth, decay, death cycle, you know, influence. And so he's like, how do you get beyond that, you know?
Well, one of the fascinating things about this, and definitely there's an element here of a sort of transcendental nature, because when he, like, when he's looking down on the lines, he can see that he sees them as straight lines in the two-dimensional world. And he's like, why don't you turning to your side? And he's like, what do you mean, I don't, you know, to my side, I don't have a side? And he's like, yeah, I can see your whole length. And he's like, you mean you can see my insides? And so, and then the same thing when the sphere is talking to the square, it says that he can look down on the square and sees it as a square. And he's like, go that direction. And he's like, you mean my inside? So it's this idea of, like, to go outward, you go inward.
Mm-hmm.
I really liked that aspect of it, that when he's, every time they try and explain to one of the other dimensions, like, that there is another direction, they go, you mean my inside? Which, of course, is technically wrong in the aspect of what he wants them to do, but it's also kind of right. So what I found so fascinating, though, and this is where we go to the idea of, are we, when we think we are ascending, are we really descending? And it occurred to me why there is a strange sort of similarity between a Mark LeClaire's Gnostic experience of being dark and alone and all this sort of stuff, and a Jake Kotzian sort of idea of transcendence of, becoming one with the all. And that it's kind of the same thing. It's just, do you want to be one with the all, or do you find that lonely because you're missing the complexity of multiple personalities? So here, on of all things, page 93, the square, who goes to all these different dimensions, he ends up going to the land of no dimensions. So first he's in a two-dimensional world, he goes to a one-dimensional world, just a straight line, and then he goes to point land, where there's no dimensions. And this thing is just a few paragraphs because it's basically, there's not much to it. He says, "Look yonder," said my guide, "in flatland thou hast lived, in wineland thou hast received a vision, thou hast soared with me to the heights of spaceland. Now, in order to complete the range of thy experience, I conduct thee downward to the lowest depth of existence, even to the realm of pointland, the abyss of no dimensions. Behold yon miserable creature. That point is a being like ourselves, but confined to the non-dimensional gulf. He is himself his own world, his own universe. Of any other than himself, he can form no conception. He knows not length, nor breadth, nor height, for he has had no experience of them. He has no cognizance even of the number two, nor has he thought of plurality, for he is himself his one and all, being really nothing. Yet mark his perfect self-contentment, and hence learn this lesson, that to be self-contained is to be vile and ignorant, and that to aspire is better than to be blindly and impotently happy. Now listen." He ceased, and there arose from the little buzzing creature a tiny, low, monotonous, but distinct tinkling, as from one of your spaceland phonographs, from which I caught these words: "Infinite beatitude of existence, it is, and there is none else besides it." "What," said I, "does the puny creature mean by it?" "He means himself," said the sphere. "Have you not noticed before now that babies and babyish people, who cannot distinguish themselves from the world, speak of themselves in the third person? But hush." Quote, "It fills all space," continued the little soliloquizing creature, "and what it fills, it is. What it thinks, that it utters. And what it utters, that it hears. And it itself is thinker, utterer, hearer, thought, word, audition. It is the one, and yet the all in all. Ah, the happiness of being." And then it goes on for like another page. I'm not going to keep reading. But basically, he tries to explain to it about something else, and it can't even comprehend that someone else is talking to it. So it goes like, wow, that I could have such crazy thoughts and all this sort of stuff. But I find it fascinating that you have this idea of, here's this thing who sees itself as being the all, and that it's so happy. And here we have the idea of joy, to ascend to the all being joy. It actually, the last thing it says is, "Ah, the divine creative power of the all in one. Ah, the joy of being." That's the point's last words. So this idea that when we, maybe in psychedelic experiences or as a, you know, some sort of mystical experience, whatever we want to say, that we're definitely noticing a shift in dimensions, but could we not just as easily, using this as a sort of crude example, could we not just as easily be shifting into a more limited dimensionality and thinking that we've ascended when really we've become more confined?
Right. I feel like both are true in the sense that things need to be recognized as malleable before they can be reshaped. And this is like the essence of alchemy is, you know, separation, coagulation, and reuniting. And that it's not all about the coagulation. The coagulation makes another ascent possible, because you have to descend before you can ascend again and reestablish things on another level of understanding. And that's like the meaning of the supernal triad on the tree. It's not an end, it's another beginning, right?
Yes.
So, yeah. And that's how I take the meaning of the lust card, to recognize that the tree itself can be reshaped, and it is a malleable structure. There's nothing absolutely fixed about it. The only thing is that there's certain dynamics that are at place that you can't ultimately escape from. I feel like we have Andros on the line, and I'm interested in some of your ideas.
I'm listening right now. This is a very interesting conversation. I have to be, a lot of the stuff I'm not as familiar with, so I'm just...
You're just hanging out and taking it in.
Just listening and learning.
Okay.
Well,
and avoiding, there's a lot of jokes I want to make, but they're basically not a place.
Please make them.
Yeah. Make
them. the opportunity went by, but the next time one comes, I'll jump in.
Okay.
Well, surely, I mean, this is not, I mean, you know, you could take how many spiritual traditions talk about, you know, becoming one with the all, or recognizing that we're all one. And I agree with you, David, that it's sort of like almost paradoxically that they're both true. It's not that I disregard that we're all one, and yet that's only true on one level. And perhaps, you know, again, using this as an example, I really liked the sort of the narrative or the model that this book presented. It's not that I'm, you know, subscribing to it or trying to preach it as a specific truth. I'm saying I just really liked that the way that it framed it, that when we talk all being one is true on a certain level, yet we are also individuals. So it's the idea of, you know, do we want to further individuate, and does that mean advancing into higher dimensions? You know, I don't mean to take this whole thing so literal. I'm trying to posit this in some sort of context. So even if you say you're not familiar with, you know, this book or whatever, but what about the ideas of how many traditions say we are all one, or that you want to reunite with Source and all this sort of stuff?
Well, I mean, I just tend to think that it's the, like, all mystics are hamstrung by language, unless you happen to have a language that is capable of expressing paradox. And the only thing that I know that does that is art, you know, whether it's music or poetry. And then that opens itself up to interpretation. So, like, the idea of whether we're all one, or whether, you know, whether it's all about becoming individuated or becoming part of the whole, is like one of these paradoxes that language sets us up with, where in reality, it's totally possible for it to be both. You know, like,
absolutely.
Yes, to totally become yourself. When you find out, when you totally get to know yourself, you find that you are one with everything.
Yeah.
And then when you try and talk to people about it, it's going to be like those characters in the book.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
You know.
It was really, I found there is a version of this book for free online. I will include a link to it in the show notes for this episode if anyone wants to check it out. It's like only 100 pages. It's a pretty short little novella, but it's really, really fun.
It actually reminds me of
Go on.
Thus Spake Zarathustra.
I just remember that book made the rounds at my high school, and I don't think I actually read all of it, but because I had so many people who told me the story, like you're telling it, you know, that was like this, you know, gee whiz moment for a bunch of stoner high schoolers.
Yeah.
Back when I was one of them.
I think that's the point of the book. Just for me, since I've been meditating on this idea of do we sometimes think we're ascending when we're descending? Do we sometimes have our maps upside down? And also the idea of confining dimensionality versus multiple dimensionality. It just, like, again, for me, the gee whiz moment is more the sink of reading it when I did.
Right.
So, but it's definitely a good read for anybody, I think. It's pretty interesting.
It reminds me of The Point with Ringo Starr. Have you ever seen that?
No.
The cartoon.
No, Harry Nilsson's The Point.
Yeah, it's I mean, it's Ringo Starr and Dustin Hoffman, which is kind of funny if you think about Dustin Hoffman much, much later in I Heart Huckabee's bringing out the blanket, talking about how everything's one, and here he is in The Point. Kind of funny.
Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure that what's his name, director David, who directed I Heart Huckabees? I'm forgetting, I'm blanking his name right. David O. Russell.
Yeah.
Pretty sure David O. Russell was aware of that.
Uh-huh. That would make sense. That's another element. Kind of funny.
Hey, Andros, do you have any interest in reading to the audience what you read to me last night?
Oh, yeah. I came across... sometimes I do this, like I'll just find a textbook in the free box and then I'll just read it slowly. It might take me a year to just read through this one. And this was the film, book I found is a film history, an introduction, third edition. It's from McGraw-Hill, written by Kristen Thompson and David Bordwell. And it's walking through the history of film from the very beginning to now. And I'm at 1918 and I'm reading about the French Impressionist movement. And I came across these two paragraphs that this kind of blew my mind, where they're describing pretty much what we're doing. So I'll just read these two paragraphs for you. They're talking about the concept of photogene. That's spelled photo, P-H-O-T-O-G-E-N-I-E with an accent over the E, the second E. So, photogene and rhythm. In trying to define the nature of the film image, the Impressionists often referred to the concept of photogene, a term that indicates something more complex than an object simply being photogenic. For them, photogene was the basis of cinema. Louis Dulac popularized the term around 1918, using it to define that quality that distinguishes a film shot from the original object photographed. The process of filming, according to Deluc, lends an object a new expressiveness by giving the viewer a fresh perception of it. Kirsanoff wrote, and this is what I love, each thing existing in the world knows another existence on screen. As this sentence suggests, photogene could become a mystical concept. If we pin it down a bit, we can say that photogene is created by the properties of the camera. Framing isolates the object from their environment. Black and white film stock transforms their appearance. Special optical effects further change them, and so on. By such means, Impressionist theorists believed the cinema gives us access to a realm beyond everyday experience. It shows us the souls of people and the essence of objects. That, to me, is a spot-on definition of synchromysticism as we're playing with it. Except it was written, these are French Impressionists from 1918. And the difference between them and us is that they're seeing it in one image and we have the whole world of images to go off of. We have a century of images at this point.
I was sending you last night, so it's like they didn't even have the full archive of data to prove their theory. But I think that we ended up, now that we have 100 years, a century of film, and we're able to do this, it's almost like now there's a large enough data pool, we can prove that theory true.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's what, like, Will's film about me, like, he's saying that all these crappy films that I made reveal my soul in some way that is impossible. Unless this, except it can be explained through the theory of photogene. That the act of photographing something captures something of the essence of that thing, be it a person or a thing.
That's like also bringing in the dimensionality, because you're taking something that's alive and it has four dimensions if you look at time as the fourth dimension of space, which is the third dimension. And you're replicating it on a screen, which is literally two dimensions. So it reminds me of the end of The Shining when they zoom in on the picture of Jack. You know, it's like he was in, he was in the box, and now he's on a flat surface. Now he's on a square. He's gone from Jack in the box to Jack in the square. But that you could look at it that you're literally, when you replicate the thing, you get, I don't know how to explain it, you have archetypes become more apparent than they may have been before, because you're simplifying, you're breaking down the object and you're simplifying it, and in that simplicity you can derive, you can extrapolate information that you may not have been to before, because you're freezing it, so to speak. I don't know.
Yeah.
I like that you said, I hadn't considered the idea that Jack goes from Jack in the box to the two-dimensional is sort of what I was kind of getting at, right? But that he's moving in the other direction.
Yeah, he thinks he's going forward, but he's really going, breaking it down. And then, yeah.
One step forward, two steps back.
Yeah.
Andras, can you spell for me again the Genet? Do you know, I mean, I don't know shit about French. Is that the correct pronunciation? Or
I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it. It's photo, the word photo, P-H-O-T-O, all one word, G-E with a accent over it, N-I-E.
Because isn't that if you just broke that off, and again, I'm not saying this is the correct pronunciation, I'm just playing sync.
The genie of the photo?
Yeah, it's like genie, yeah. Which is, of course, comes from the jinn, the idea that like the genie of the lamp or something, that there is this essence, like the same idea of a genie trapped in a lamp would be like an essence trapped in an object.
Yeah, genie is literally higher self, right? Like, I mean, it's yourself.
Yeah.
Is the meaning. It's like, that's where genius and genie have the same root, so. Your voice is doing the thing it was earlier, Alan, a little bit.
Oh,
not as bad as it was before, but I don't know if something happened.
Nothing. I didn't change anything.
Okay.
Sorry.
That's all right. Now you sound better. Maybe you just scooted in or something. Anyways,
I just think that it makes me want to do a little bit more research, because you can even hear it. Like, here they're saying, they're writing off. He says, each thing existing in the world knows another existence on screen. As this sentence suggests, photo, genie, or Janae could become a mystical concept. But let's move on. Like, they don't address that.
Mm-hmm.
But it makes me wonder if some of these French impressionists wrote about what we would call synchromysticism.
The early silent films had they're very similar to the old lantern shows. Like, there's a whole mystical side to it that I think that in its dawning, it was more obvious. I find it very obvious now, but it's harder because of the superficiality of a lot of film, it's harder for people to see. But there's definitely a more obvious mystical side in the older silent films. That the dawning of cinema was very weird.
Yeah.
In that
well,
way.
I mean, there were. I mean, of course. I mean, they talk about how what an amazing thing it was for people to see the Earth from outer space, but. Can you imagine seeing your own face?
Right.
In a picture, like in action, not like looking into a mirror. Like, that's me driving in a moving picture. That's me riding on a horse. That's me kissing a girl. Oh my, what? I mean, what does that do to your psychology?
I had found, I didn't find, but I had access to my great grandparents. A piece of film, and it was like 8 seconds long, you know. Someone in my family was able to find it and get it like mildly restored. And it's so funny because it's just like the way that we would pose for a photograph. It's like people standing there, and then like there's no sound obviously, but then someone's like obviously like, okay, now walk. So they're just like standing still, and you see them like, you know, like posing for a photograph. And now they just like walk forward a few steps. And like, that's the film. And it's like, because it's like, holy shit, we have a
Like, what's, you know, like, we know how to take a picture, and now move in it. You know, it's like, but it's, but so it's like, it's kind of funny, and it's also like incredibly revealing. I think what you're saying, Andras, of like the novelty of you can move. Like, yeah, we know, like, you know, you're still trying to figure it out, and this is obviously not like a, you know, a brilliant filmmaker. This is some family thing, but just to say that the average person's looking at it as like, okay, I know how to take a, I know what a photo is, and now, holy shit, look, you can move in it. It really is that extra dimension, right? It's going from a two, again, the film is still a two-dimensional object, but now you are able to move within those two dimensions. If that makes sense.
And, you know, there are those, you know, the, you know, the stories about the tribes that would, that wouldn't let someone take their picture because it would take part of their soul. Right?
Yeah, that, exactly. And that's what I was mentioning to you last night. It's like, I could see how one, if there's a, if we're all recognizing a certain truth to this idea, and I could very easily see how someone could take it in the sense of like, are you capturing some of my essence? I mean, I don't want that. Maybe I don't want to be captured in the film, in the two-dimensional world, or whatever. You know, if someone, again, like someone being afraid of going into the screen or the cube or the whatever, an Amish person that doesn't want their photo taken or something like that, I get it. And yet from an artistic side, we're also seeing that, Andres, when I mentioned that, your point was it's not so much capturing, or that it could be, maybe both are true, that in one respect it's capturing, but in so doing, it's also revealing. You were saying that it was, the emphasis you were putting on that phrase was that it's revealing the essence, revealing the soul.
Exactly. And what they're saying is that, what I like what they say here is that it's, I just love that phrase. It shows us the souls of people and the essence of objects. I just love that. It's so simple. And it, I think that, did we lose you?
No, he just muted his mic so you could hear better.
Yeah, I just muted.
That's, I think that's what we're all reaching towards with this work that we're doing, is getting to the essence, the souls of people and the essence of objects. And I think that's something that this is the next, sort of the next wave of what we're doing, is when more filmmakers start to incorporate this work into their work, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I think people do it anyway. I mean, if you put a sled in your movie, you're referencing Citizen Kane.
Right. I was just, as soon as you said it, I was all Rosebud.
Right. You know, there are certain things that are like that, that are like that in film. And I mean, some are specific like that, and some are general. Like, what has been filmed more than anything else? A gun, right? That was that first Thomas Edison, of the guy shooting the gun into the camera. You know, and that's been, I mean, so there is no specific gun in film. There is just the gun. When the gun shows up, you have all the other guns that you've ever seen are there.
Right?
Whereas there are also very specific things, like Orson Welles owns the sled. Nobody owns the car, and nobody owns the gun. Nobody owns the horse. But
camera's a gun.
Yeah.
I always see it like, whenever I see the reels, which most often seem to have the six circles on the reel of the film, and as they turn, you literally, like, it's a classic image. It reminds me of the Zarka Hebrew musical note indicator that's throughout the Torah in certain places, and it's oddly used, but it shows up on the two of discs in tarot decks. So in Marseille tarot, you can see it where there's the two discs, but they have like a tape moving through it. It's like an S right? And like in Crowley's Two of Discs, it's the card that they usually write their names on, whoever did the deck. And so in Marseille Tarot, it says Marseille, right? But like in Crowley's, you have it's a serpent that's moving and swallowing his tail with a little crown. But it's interesting because I see that as like the reel of tape of the film stock moving through the channel, you know. But the fact that it's like actually six circles rotating around a seventh point is totally Metatron. And you can see like even like the revolver, the six shooter gun is the same thing. And so whenever I see somebody getting filmed, it's like you're literally like, it's a, like a symbolic death to have them filming you on a certain level, symbolically speaking, you know, which is kind of interesting.
Are you paying attention at all to this new film that's coming out called Parkland?
What is it called?
Parkland.
No.
It's a Kennedy assassination movie produced by Tom Hanks and Gary Getzman.
Uh-oh.
Where Paul Giamatti, it looks like it's a lot about Zapruder. So there's a whole thing with Paul Giamatti playing Zapruder and coming out and filming. Like if you watch the preview, it'll give you a good idea.
Okay.
It's probably gonna be frustrating as hell, but also.
Yeah, I bet that's my initial reaction. I can't watch JFK. With Kevin Costner, I couldn't even when I was younger, for that reason. It's just too frustrating. There's just
What was it that frustrated you?
I really have a hard time, with just about all his films, just because it doesn't.
Oliver Stone's film or Kevin Costner's?
Oliver Stone's films. That they're like this. It's like we're talking about how when you take a photograph of a reality in the first place, you're removing you could be removing yourself from the reality of something, but you're also getting other, you're making it possible to make other connections. I feel like I've talked about this before. I see the potential of what each one could be, and I feel like he just moves through them so quickly. I think he should be putting about twice the amount of energy that he's putting into each film in order to convey and to do, to not just produce these, like, he takes like the consensus view of the thing and just reflects that back instead of like opening up to, and there'll be things that are like really crucial in a lot of his stories that are just completely left out. That would just be so, like, they need to be there and they're just not there. Things that were pointed out during those hearings, I guess you would call them, reopening the Kennedy case. It's just like there was things that came to light that are just never mentioned there. And that is really frustrating for me. I have a hard time watching it.
I hate the Doors. I don't know if I agree with you. I have a whole theory about Oliver Stone that he never stopped being CIA and that his films are like a psyop, and that he sort of plays like he's the radical muckraking progressive journalistic filmmaker, but if you look at all of his films, the ultimate message is really deeply conservative and revisionist history in a way that bolsters the very things that he seems to be poking at, you know?
Yeah, like really obviously too, is what it feels to me, which is why I get like, and I'm actually surprised to hear you say that, because almost every time I say what I'm saying, people don't generally seem to feel the same way. They're like, oh, I thought that movie was good. And yeah, I'm like, I'll have a conversation with somebody about JFK or about Hoffa or about any of these things. And like, I'm like hearing what they're saying. I'm like, oh no, you're talking about the Oliver Stone movie. I'm like, everything you said is like the Oliver Stone movie. It's not a history lesson to watch an Oliver Stone film.
Right.
You're not, and like they'd show, when we were in school, every so often we would get like an Oliver Stone film to show us the information. I'm like, why the fuck are we watching this film to, like, in high school, you know? I'm like, what? This Nixon? Jesus Christ. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you just go through them, I mean, Nixon, and, like, he does a better job of making Nixon look like a sympathetic character than you could ever do.
Right.
He muddies the waters on the Kennedy assassination by being sloppy. He turns the Doors film into an anti-drug movie.
Yeah.
You know, which I think is, like, I had a band, and I was managed by a guy, by some, one of the guys who, actually the guy who signed the Doors to their first deal before they went left and went to Elektra. He signed them to CBS. And so I got sort of the inside response from the Doors. Like, he was telling me how Manzarek and the rest of them responded to the movie. And they were all just sort of like appalled, because they turned Morrison into this sort of wide-eyed, drug-addled idiot.
Yeah.
Pretty boy. And they're like, Jim Morrison was the smartest, funniest guy you would ever want to meet. He was hilarious. And he was super fucking smart. And instead, and then I've read more, and you find out that part of the reason for that is that that Patty, his girlfriend, who died of a heroin overdose, her family owns the right to all Jim Morrison stuff, because he gave it to her, and she died, and so her family wouldn't let Oliver Stone make a movie about their daughter, who was a heroin addict and, you know, a very erratic person. It turns into this story about the girl next door who falls for this bad boy.
Right. Yeah, just in a real, if you know, two cents about the depth of what was going on there, it's just like, what the fuck am I watching? Yeah, I can't watch it. So yeah, that was, you know, that's my feelings on Oliver Stone. So
I'll tell you, you know, it's funny. So I was thinking about that when I saw the previews for this movie Parkland, and I just was thinking, this is going to frustrate me, but it's probably going to be better than JFK.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
Of course, we're going to have to watch it. You can't not watch it.
Totally.
You know?
Who's making Parkland?
Directed by... Well, it's produced by Gary Getzman and Tom Hanks.
Right. Tom Hanks. That's right. I know he's gonna be in it also.
No, he's not in it.
Really? I had heard originally he was gonna be in it.
Well, if he is, he's not on the poster.
Okay.
The names on the poster are Zac Efron, Marcia Gay Harden, Billy Bob Thornton, Jackie Weaver, and Paul Giamatti. And it seems like the story revolves around, like, this a brand new intern who's played by Zac Efron, who's the doctor at Parkland Hospital where they bring Kennedy. And Paul Giamatti is a pruder. And it just, you know, it covers that day.
Right.
Did you guys see that they're coming out with the new Xbox on JFK Day? On the assassination day?
Oh, that's perfect. Again, taking it back to X being the Wheel of Fortune.
Yeah. Totally.
Hey, you guys, I just want to say, I'm going to have to jump in like 5 minutes. I have a noon appointment here, so.
Okay.
I don't want to, look, just letting you know that.
Sure.
That's what's up. Okay.
Yeah, that's perfect for me as well, because some people knocked on my door, and that's why I disappeared for a minute.
Okay. Huh. Well...
I'll throw this out at you. So I don't know if you guys were talking about JFK the whole time, but here's something, is that, you know, taking it back to the 77777, I mean, these are just like random little tidbits from Suicide Kings, but one of the things I've talked about is, so 77 is Oz, and you have Oswald. You have the fact that JFK, as soon as he gets shot, his limo, driving from the scene to Parkland Hospital, drives on Highway 77. His license plate number is on the limo is GG300. So GG, of course, being 77. And then 300, is 300 the value of shin?
Yeah.
Yeah, so 300 is the value of shin.
Judgment.
And you have judgment. You also have that the whole layout of Dealey Plaza and the triple underpass is a shin in and of itself. And all these different things. But now you have also that something I was considering was that the rifle that Oswald is technically to have used is a bolt action rifle. And you have the idea of like the lightning bolt. And then again, corresponding to Kundalini, you have so JFK gets shot, gets taken to Parkland where he's declared dead. Then Oswald gets shot, dies at Parkland. And then, like, 2 years later, what's-his-face, Jack Ruby dies at Parkland. He dies of cancer at Parkland. So all three of them die at Parkland, which is pretty interesting as a sort of tangent sink here. But the gun that Ruby uses to shoot Oswald is a Cobra. And as, again, in that synchronized episode 3, we talk about the idea of the Cobra being a symbol of royal authority, of Kundalini, and also of this sort of Eye of Ra. So for the old school conspiracy theorists who said that Dealey Plaza was laid out as a triangle, this is like an old school thing, is that Dewey Plaza is essentially a triangle. JFK gets shot at this triangular point, and they're saying this is proof that it's the Illuminati, you know, sort of taking him out as he's in the position of the eye, which is like, eh, okay. It's mildly interesting. I think the idea of the... There's so much more to Dealey Plaza than just that. But again, on one level, that's interesting. What I find interesting adding to that is if Dealey Plaza was this eye in the pyramid, that he would use the Cobra revolver to kill Oswald. And just that the Cobra is analogous with all these other things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Huh. You know, the judgment being the shin card, you can see shin being directly represented, not in the Eon version, but in the Rider deck, you can see that there's three coffins. There's three beings emerging from three coffins. The shin itself is said to represent the three pillars of the Tree of Life, and the three little yuds at the top of those lines, if you look at the shin as like a sideways three, right, facing upwards, that those three yuds represent the three supernal spherot. And so literally what you see as the resurrection with the trumpet, they're being called forth, it's like these dead beings emerging, is literally that you have the destruction of the temple, which is the tower card or house of God, and that the showing that the temple will get rebuilt is literally that the two pillars of the temple, you know, you have the two pillars of the Tree of Life, that it's literally the resurrection of the temple. So the temple collapses and then the temple gets rebuilt. This is an interesting point here when you look at it in terms of literally, like, when the president is killed, let us pray. Like, it's the being itself is another temple. So it's all the symbolism that you should see connected with the temple, archetypally, you should see with our leaders, with the king kill. The king kill and the temple go together, in other words.
That's what I've been saying. Yeah, they are the temple. Yeah. And particularly, like, you know, the idea of getting shot in the head. The idea that you have two temples on either side of your skull, you know, that to me is pretty significant. But just as you said, on a sort of wider scheme, that they would be essentially interchangeable. Andras, you're heading out? Is he already gone?
Yeah, no, I'm heading out right now.
All right, man. Thanks for being on.
Have a great day, and I'll catch you the next time we talk.
All right, man. Thanks.
Be well.
Bye.
I'm thinking it would be ideal for me if we could end it here.
That's fine. Yeah.
Go ahead.
I have one request from you. Could you send me, have you updated Suicide Kings a little bit more?
Yeah, I have some updates to it. If you want a more, I think I sent you I guess that was Jason asked me for a more updated version. I could send you a more updated version.
I would really appreciate that because this is, I've been thinking about it a lot, so.
But I've just finished editing this other guy's book, which you might actually find interesting. It's this guy wrote this book, which is basically talking about the Gospel of Thomas as part of the Nag Hammadi texts, how you have this Gnostic text that seems to be validating that what the historical Jesus was preaching was a yogic tradition. And this is, it's nothing entirely new, but he takes line by line of the Gospel of Thomas and showing how it correlates to different Vedas and stuff like that.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, I love that stuff. Yeah.
But I just, I'm wrapping up this guy's book. We have a final draft. I just started formatting it last week, and I'm just about, probably just a few weeks left on that, and then I'm my plan is to get right back into Suicide Kings and just try and, you know, revise what I have and keep going full force ahead. So I'll send you what I have, but I'm going to, in the next few weeks, I'm going to get back to it. So there'll be a lot more very soon.
Just really, really quickly, I'm sure you've probably seen this, but ignore the picture to the left. But just Oswald with the 112-723 arrest shot.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you look at Jim Morrison's 237 one.
Oh, yeah. That? Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, I just... of all the numbers, yeah, it's really something. Anyways.
Yeah.
I'm not going anywhere with that other than isn't that interesting. So, anyways, man, take care.
You thank too. You. No, thank you, buddy.
Then the truth is found to be lies. And all the hope within you dies. Then what? Grace Slick, Marty Balin, Paul Kentner, Jorma something. These are the members of the airplane.
I have no idea what's next. Other side? Other side of this life.